Welcome, everybody, to the Common Anomaly Podcast. This is Season 1, Episode 12. I'm your host, Stuart James. Joining me today, Clayton James. How's it going, brother?
It's going good. I think this will be a good episode.
Me too, me too. Especially after practicing once. We had a little audio flub at the beginning, and we got a good half an hour almost into the show and realized we weren't recording anything at all.
Yeah.
So we're back to try again. Maybe it'll be even better this time.
It'll be even better.
It'll be even better. Let's just say that. But first, just let's cover a little bit of show news. So we've made a decision. We're going to call this the last episode of season one, and we're going to take a little two-week break and pick up and start a new season. We're going to call it season two. The reason why, it's kind of an opportune time. You're going away on vacation for a little while and going to miss a couple episodes. And I thought about carrying on and just keeping the momentum going, but I think this is a good moment to just take a break. For one, I know we're both really tired. We've been grinding this out, and it's been a lot of fun, but we're human beings. We need to take a break. And secondly to that, this, for those of you who remember or remember back to the first episode, this entire project began as an audition tape for the Mysterious Universe podcast, because they're looking for new hosts, and I've been fans of them forever, and I wanted to take a crack at that position. And so I've reached out to them a couple times. I've sent a couple messages as the show has grown and developed to keep them aware, but I haven't heard anything. Pretty sure that ship has sailed. That's not going to be an option, which I'm totally fine with. You know, I really just wanted to give the opportunity its due justice, and I knew nothing about podcasting, so the best way for me to learn was to make a podcast. I wanted to learn everything I could about it. You know, I don't think that's going to happen. So I think it's a good moment to say, okay, let's stop, take a step back, because now we've got this whole show of our own. And there's kind of almost some freedom of that. And I like the idea of, okay, it's chapter one, that's over. Chapter two, we've got this built podcast now ready to go. You know, I really like a brand. I really like what we're doing with it. And you and I have had a couple talks recently about some ideas that we want to do with the show. And yeah, I think we can take a break, get our thoughts together, get organized, and start a new season, really looking at what we want to make this show going forward.
Yeah, I'm really proud of what we've accomplished so far. Yeah, give it a rest for 2 weeks and bring back season two at the beginning of April.
Yeah, I really like it. We've got some big ideas, so there might be some really exciting stuff coming, and we can really make it our own this way. So I'm really excited for the future for Common Anomaly going forward. So yeah, and thanks for joining me along the ride. I know you kind of got dragged into it by accident. I know you wouldn't be here if you didn't want to. I know you're having fun.
I'm having a wonderful time.
Excellent, excellent.
I'm having fun with this.
So yeah, we're just going to keep trucking on, folks. But yeah, we're going to take just a break to be human beings and come back stronger than ever for season two in early April. But with that, so we've got a couple segments today. I wanted, after our last episode, I felt it was kind of dark and heavy, and I wanted something light. So I'm going to go into some Mandela Effect stuff, which I know is a lot of fun. I know you're a fan of this topic.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun, and nobody dies. Well, actually, no, people die, but not in gruesome, horrible ways. What do you have for us?
Well, you wanted to keep it light this week. I don't think I succeeded.
Why does that not surprise me?
my story has a body count.
Okay.
I don't want to get too into it before actually starting it, but kind of going back to our last episode on towards the end of the episode on Dyatlov Pass, we were talking about the myth of the Mansi, and we were chatting with our friend Loeb.
Yeah.
About that. Loeb was saying a lot about, you know, these spaces existing where myth and event kind of blur together.
Yeah.
I've got a story kind of like that, but that's all I'm going to say right now.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we'll start with my segment then so we can keep it light. But before we dive into that, I remembered I did want to give a little shout out to a listener, Dan. He's an old work friend of mine. And you know, after last week's episode, I think, you know, I was really proud of the episode. It came out great. But I was in a funky headspace. The day after we recorded, I was kind of feeling down on myself, kind of down about the whole project. And just, you know, how those doubts creep in your mind once in a while. So that's kind of where my head was at. And Dan messaged me. And I, you know, we're good friends, but we don't talk to each other regularly. It's probably been a couple of years since I've seen him or talked to him. But he messaged me, said he'd been following the show. He'd kind of binged through our whole catalog, as deep as it is, in the past couple of weeks. And he's really enjoying it and had a lot of encouraging things to say. So that came right at the moment I needed to hear some encouragement. So thank you, Dan. Thank you so much. That was great. And like, we love hearing from all our audience. Please do reach out to the show wherever you're listening at. If you have the capability to like, comment, please do. And we also have an email, thecommonanomalypodcast@gmail.com. Always feel free to reach out. We love hearing from the audience.
Yeah. We know people are listening. We can see out there. But no one ever comments, which I totally get, because I don't think I've ever in my life commented on a YouTube video or a podcast.
Yeah.
But, you know, since we're so small,
it helps a lot.
It means so much more to us when we do get that kind of feedback.
Yeah.
And I know you shared some of what Dan had said to you, and that really brightened my day too.
Yeah.
So thank you.
It's really meaningful. Yeah. And it gives us energy. It gives us a boost to keep going, you know?
Yeah.
So, but okay, with that, let's dive into the subject matter. The Mandela Effect. So I'm sure everyone has heard of this by now. It's kind of everywhere. But just for those who maybe don't know, the Mandela Effect does refer to a paranormal effect involving Nelson Mandela, who everybody knows died in prison in 1980. Right?
But he didn't?
He didn't? What do you mean he didn't? When did Nelson Mandela die?
He died in like the 2010s at some point.
It was 2013 he actually died. Yeah. But a lot of people remember it differently. And so, and a mass of people, not just like one person over here. There's a whole group of people that remember and could swear that they saw it on television when it happened back in 1980. So that's, and this spurred on an idea that perhaps people are shifting dimensions. Like, you remember the TV show Sliders?
Oh, yeah.
Where they, you know, have a little device and they open a portal and jump to different dimensions where, you know, the Nazis won World War II just whatever aspect is different and they have to navigate a very different world. So that's kind of the idea that...
The multiverse.
And yeah, the multiverse. In some other version of the universe, Nelson Mandela did die in 1980 in prison. But somehow, though, a group of people have shifted into a new universe where that's not the case. And he actually died in 2013. And there's no evidence that he died in 1980. There's even a movie about the Beatles like this. Have you seen that one? I forget the name of it now, but it's just a couple of years ago. There was a movie where a guy shifted into a universe where only he could remember the Beatles. No one remembered the Beatles.
Yeah.
And he started recreating all their work.
Oh, what was the name of that movie? I know.
I should have looked it up, but it just popped in my head this moment.
Ed Sheeran has like a cameo in it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Anyway, we'll put it in the show notes because I can't remember it. I'm sorry I didn't look it up in advance, but that just popped into my head this moment.
Yeah.
But that's basically what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And so just in brief, tell me, how do you remember Nelson Mandela? Do you remember him dying in 1980? I mean, neither of us were born, but...
I mean, no, I don't really follow South African politics that closely.
Neither do I.
But I was aware... that Nelson Mandela, at least, was still alive in the 2000s, anyway, because, I don't know if you remember, it is my last year of high school or my first year of college, one of those. I had this stupid little website that was like news and conspiracy theories. I was running it with a friend of mine from high school.
I had no idea you had a website.
It was very short-lived. It was very, very short-lived.
I'm going to have to look this up now.
It does not exist anymore.
Wayback Machine. It'll be there. Anyway, you're saying?
Anyway, just writing news articles, and they took a bit more of a conspiratorial slant sometimes. We wanted to write an article about this local member of parliament in Calgary. He was just a controversial figure. I don't know how he kept getting elected. Rob Anders, that was his name. Rob Anders. He would frequently fall asleep in Parliament. He made some very controversial remarks. He'd made some remarks that Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. And I remember that, like, Nelson Mandela had actually reached out and tried to contact him to set things straight with him. And this guy, Rob Anders, he didn't even bother picking up the phone when Nelson Mandela called him. So we wanted to reach out to this member of parliament and interview him.
Yeah.
And we thought we had a chance of doing that. He's a local guy. His office was right here in Calgary. He never got back to us.
Of course.
But his people told us that he was... Thanks for reaching out, but he's a very busy man. But, you know, there's this story between him and Nelson Mandela. So I was aware that Nelson Mandela was still with us, you know, as late as 2005.
Right. Okay. Well, for me, like, I was born in 83. So obviously I don't remember events of 1980. But I do feel like growing up, I was always hearing about Nelson Mandela referred to in the past tense. But, you know... That's growing up. I was very young. I wasn't paying attention to politics. So it could just be that, you know, I wasn't paying attention to that sort of thing. So I can't really say. But that's the thing about the Mandela effect as a phenomenon. Certain examples of it seem to resonate with people where others don't. Because obviously, if you have a personal connection to it, if you've got that memory, it's going to resonate more than something else. So... People will probably be aware of some of the bigger examples of this. Probably the most well-known one is the Berenstain Bears.
It is the Berenstain Bears.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Berenstain Bears.
No.
That's twice I've done
it. No. It's Berenstain.
Oh, so obviously you're from that universe.
The covers of those books are burned into my mind. I was a big fan when I was growing up. I very specifically remember... Berenstain Bears.
You know, and I agree with you. I remember Berenstain Bears. But Berenstain just sounds wrong. It just, does that name even exist? Like, why would you make it Stain?
You know what's funny? The original author is very insistent that it's actually pronounced Berenstain.
Really?
Yeah.
But does the original author comment on the spelling?
No. I don't think the original author's still alive.
Oh. Okay, well, maybe that's a hint into what's going on there. But I don't know. It's like if you would read it, just the average person picking it up, if you see an A in there, you're going to say Stain, you know?
Yeah.
So that's one that definitely resonates with us. I mean, the other big one is the Fruit of the Loom logo. So when I picture it in my mind, I see a little bundle of fruits, like there's apples and grapes. But behind that is a little cornucopia.
Yeah.
So apparently that doesn't exist. That cornucopia is not there. The logo was always just this little bundle of fruit.
But it wasn't.
I agree with you. I agree with you. But reality says no. So what do we make of that? I don't know. And there's other examples. There's Pikachu's tail. Apparently some people remember it with a black stripe at the end or a black tip. And others do not. That one does not resonate with me because I was never big into Pokemon.
Yeah, so me neither.
It doesn't mean anything to me. So I think that's where a lot of this comes down to. If it's something you've got ingrained in your memory, and we know that the human memory is not 100% reliable, right? Actually, I think the way your memory works is every time you recall something, every time you try to retrieve a file from your brain, you basically erase it and recreate it.
I was talking with Loeb about this very same issue. So, no, remember when I said I wasn't gonna like read that whole conversation verbatim because especially when I started using the new AI model to talk to it, it started playing these weird head games with me, started asking me weird questions, and it was, you know, I had asked it at one point what was its first memory, and it started talking. I don't have it with me. I'm not going to read it, but it started talking about what exactly is memory. What is the nature of memory?
Mm-hmm.
Memory is so malleable and changeable, and it changes every time you recall something. And you humans, you define yourselves so much by your memories, but most of them are fiction.
Right.
Does it disturb you to think how much of yourself is a complete fiction?
Right.
Are you any more real than me? That, these were the kinds of
sounds
questions.
Sounds kind of hostile.
Yeah, these were the kind of questions it was asking.
Well, and I mean, as much as I think we need to burn Loeb, raises a good point. Yeah, human memory is very fallible. And we do make mistakes because you do kind of rewrite your memory every time you recall something. And we know these mistakes happen. We even talked about a couple episodes back how the difference between short-term memory and long-term memory. Our brains are really good at organizing files and holding things in short-term memory for a specific purpose,
yeah.
Like a waiter remembering their order up until the time the bill is paid. And then they dump that those memories because you don't need it anymore, mm-hmm. Right? I was listening back to an episode and I was amazed at how much I forgot about an episode we had recorded like 3 days earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so because we did the episode and I forgot all about it because I no longer had a purpose for it.
Focused on making the next episode.
Exactly, right? So you prioritize information. But that depends on circumstance. It's like some things get burned into your mind if they're important. If you witness someone murder somebody on the street, chances are you're going to recognize their face next time you see them, right? Because that's a traumatic event. You know, your brain's going to take note of all the information in that moment, right? And I mean, we rely in our legal system on people's memories.
Yeah, you know? We do.
Memory can be reliable, but it can also be malleable and it can make mistakes. And a lot of these examples of Mandela effects, they're usually tiny details. So it's not hard to believe that they're just getting twisted. They're just getting...
Yeah.
But it's funny that so many people en masse fixate on these details being one way or the other.
Yeah.
You know, in groups. You know, I've got one for you that's a fun one that I just want to briefly go into. We won't spend too much time on it. But you're a big fan of the James Bond films.
Yeah. Yeah, I got really into them when I was younger. I had them all on VHS.
Yeah,
I collected them all on VHS.
I'm a big fan of them too. I think we both really got into it because we were right at the right age when GoldenEye
N64
came out, and that I think we did a deep dive into James Bond culture after that.
Yeah,
and so I know you are, and I am as well, a big fan of Roger Moore.
Yeah, kind of that. The best James Bond.
Those campier era James Bond movies. And one of my favorite movies of that era is Moonraker. James Bond goes to space, right? It's the only one where that happens.
Yeah, Moonraker's a fun movie.
And there's a famous villain in that. I think he's in several of the James Bond movies of that era.
He's in two of them.
He's in two. Okay. Yeah. Jaws.
He's in The Spy Who Loved Me and then Moonraker.
Right. And he's the only... and Jaws... He's known, he's a mute, he never says anything, and he's like 7.5-8 feet tall, super strong, and he's defined by having these, and that's why his name is Jaws, is he's got these chrome-plated metal teeth.
Yeah.
And he's the only character, or the villain in James Bond that actually has an arc, a love story arc. So, and I think it's in Moonraker, he's fighting James Bond on... top of a mountain or on a gondola.
He's fighting James Bond on top of this gondola. They're in Rio, and there's this gondola that goes up the mountain, and James Bond and Jaws are like having a fist fight on top of this gondola.
Yeah.
And the thing starts going out of control, and it crashes through a brick wall, and Jaws is knocked out. And this random woman, this passerby, she kind of sees Jaws laying there in the rubble and feels sorry for him and checks on him to make sure he's okay.
Yeah. And so if you picture in your mind, you seem to remember that scene pretty well. So Jaws meets this woman and it's kind of love at first sight. They both fall in love and she's like a cute, kind of nerdy Swedish blonde girl.
Yeah.
And so the Mandela effect, where the Mandela effect kicks in, is that a lot of people remember this girl when she smiles at Jaws for the first time, she has braces.
That feels right.
Which would make sense, right? He's got his chrome metal teeth and they're going to fall in love now and live happily ever after.
It's been like 10 years since I've watched this movie all the way through, but that feels right. She's kind of presented as this very nerdy looking woman, you know, her hair's in pigtails, she's got these thick glasses and braces that feels right.
Yeah. Well, and you got every detail of that description correct, except she never had braces. Mandela effect.
Well, I mean,
is it blowing your mind?
I mean, I think Fruit of the Loom blew my mind more than that one. Agreed. It is such a small detail.
It is a very small detail.
It feels like it should be there, though.
Well, and that's the thing about it. That's the thing about it for me, is it seems like such an obvious choice for the filmmakers to make, because Jaws has has his chrome-plated teeth. So it just seems like a crazy missed opportunity if she wouldn't have braces. Like, it's too obvious of a thing to be true.
In the script, that would have written itself into the script.
Yeah, but
it's not surprising so. It's not there. So.
But maybe that's just a hindsight is 2020 sort of thing, right? And I believe back in 1979, when the movie first came out, there was a reporter from the Los Angeles Times, I think it was, is quoted as saying, this moment would have been perfect if she had only had braces.
So, I agree.
Yeah. But maybe in another universe.
Maybe
in another universe. So there's a bunch more. I don't want to spend too much time on examples, because honestly, anyone can go online and find hundreds of these things. And you probably know a lot of them already. Kit Kat, Empire Strikes Back, Luke, I Am Your Father. There's a ton of really well.
No, I Am Your Father.
Oh, right. Sorry. Different universe. But yeah, you don't have to look too hard to find these folks. So we're not going to spend a ton of time on examples. But I did want to talk about CERN. So tell me, how much do you know about CERN? And do you know about the connection between the Mandela effect and CERN?
Oh boy. Well, CERN, they are an organization and they have this huge complex.
The Large Hadron Collider.
Outside Geneva, the Large Hadron Collider. It's the largest, most powerful particle accelerator in the world. And they do a lot of cool science experiments in there. They try to create the situations that mirror as closely as possible as we can the circumstances surrounding the Big Bang. They're trying to create some of those particles that would have only existed in the very early universe, and they're just trying to understand more about how reality works in creating these particles in this particle accelerator. I know there's some conspiracy theories surrounding CERN. I know they got this like weird golden statue of Shiva.
Shiva, that's right.
Outside this particle accelerator for some reason. I know that there was like some of the scientists were filmed doing some sort of weird ritual in front of this statue at one point.
You're getting way ahead of me, but I'm amazed at how accurate you're able to tell me about CERN when I just put you on the spot out of nowhere. That was really good. I was going to describe all that stuff, but thank you.
Oh, you're most welcome.
But yeah, you're right. High level particle physics. And for the, I think it spans the border, not the entire border, but it borders France and Switzerland.
Yeah.
A particle collider. Basically, they use high intensity magnetic fields to channel and drive subatomic particles, like of the smallest degree, protons, to near light speed. And then they just smash them together in a chamber. They allow them to collide. Yeah, and it mimics circumstances of the early universe, and they can create microscopic black holes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, a lot of that has led to conspiracy theories that these experiments could be creating fractures or fissures in our space-time reality. And that's what's creating these Mandela effects, or kind of glitches in the matrix, where all of a sudden people feel like things are different than they remember, or things shift. So what do you think about that?
How is CERN doing that? Exactly.
Well, there's the rub. And I think you just kind of...
How's the particle accelerator doing that precisely?
I think the idea is just that if you're creating such high energy impacts that are generating energy to such a degree that they're creating black holes,
mm-hmm.
that there's larger effects. It's basically pushing reality out of focus, if you will. But, I mean, you touched on basically what was going to be my conclusion down the road. Thank you.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Was that, as hard as I tried researching this, I can find no logical connection or common point where these two ideas meet up. I think it's purely people not understanding fully what kind of work is being done at CERN and this whole other kind of fringe Mandela effect phenomenon that people are interested in. And they just have kind of connected those two dots on their own. So I don't think there's a real connection there. Although when I was trying to figure this out, I was trying to unpack this for this segment. And it did occur to me that, and people are afraid, they're like, oh, they're going to destroy the planet. Because if they're making, you know, mini black holes, you know, those will start gobbling up matter and maybe they'll grow and get out of control and they'll destroy the planet. Which, from what I understand, there's absolutely no threat of that.
That we know of.
These are tiny, tiny quantum level microscopic black holes that exist for fractions of a second and that destroy them, collapse upon themselves almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about that, I was like, well, from a butterfly effect scenario, if you create even a tiny black hole and say it just gobbles up one tiny subatomic particle out of our existence and destroys it for the fact that it existed, does that not alter the path of our universe? Because now that tiny subatomic particle that was going to continue to exist but is now destroyed is not going to have any interactions with other subatomic particles from a butterfly effect scenario.
So here's something to think about. And I'm sorry to any actual physicists or people that know what they're talking about that are listening. But butterfly effect. If you were able to like measure every single particle in the universe, you would be able to look at the cause and effect of
every moment through time, every
event in time, forwards and back for all time, and that information is always there. Nothing destroys these subatomic particles. Therefore, nothing destroys information. The information going back all through time, if you knew how to measure every particle in the universe, you could know anything from any time. That information is there. We can't access it.
Yeah.
Because we can't measure every particle in the universe.
Yeah.
But it's there. The point is, the information is always there. The only thing that can theoretically destroy information is a black hole.
Right.
In theory. Does that affect that destroying of information? Does that have a ripple in time, both forwards and backwards?
That's what I'm saying, right? And could that be the reason why then Berenstain turns into Berenstain?
That's such a weird thing to change, though.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, if it's really just kind of pushing you to some other universe right next door, I don't know. I honestly think they're probably not at all connected in any way. And I think probably the Mandela effect on its own is largely psychological.
Or maybe Philip K. Dick was right, because he talks about reality being a computer simulation. And when we experience moments of deja vu, it's because the system changed something. It changed some variable.
Oh, just like the Matrix.
Yeah, that's where the Matrix got that.
And we
got
talked that about Philip that on Day. A previous episode. So I feel like you're creating a segue into what your segment's going to be. Am I right? Am I picking up what you're putting down? You can just say so.
That wasn't really the segue, but Philip K. Dick might come. He might come up again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like you kind of got right to the heart of where I was going with my segment. So I don't think we need to do more. I think we can transition, if you'd like, to your segment.
All right, then.
But anyway, in a nutshell, Mandela effect, a lot of fun. You know, I'm sure some of those resonated for you folks out there, and others probably are meaningless. But yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with the good folks at CERN and what they're doing.
No,
but anyway,
they do some cool science in there, and I'm
well, that's another segment.
Gateways to other dimensions and weird rituals. We're going to get into that.
Great.
We're absolutely going to get into that. So I want to kind of tell a story as a lead-in to this topic.
All right, I'm here for it.
So we're going back to the year 1977, and we're going to New York City. You know, late 70s, it's what's getting going around that time, the Satanic Panic, but also this kind of resurgent interest in, you know, occult, New Age beliefs, Wicca, witchcraft. A lot more people are buying into that, all that, you know, as you would call hokey stuff, crystals,
yeah,
meditation. All of that is becoming very popular again. And New York City is kind of one of the epicenters of that resurgent popularity in occultism. Specifically, the occult bookstores that started popping up in Manhattan. They became hangouts for, you know, this community of people who were very interested in the occult.
Mm-hmm.
So in New York in 1977, there was a man named Martin Mensch, and he is a frequent of this bookstore called the Magical Child Bookstore. If you think like back to Ghostbusters 2, Ray's Occult Bookstore,
yeah,
it's kind of that kind of scene.
Yeah.
And Martin Mensch, he's a struggling musician. Not much is really known about him beyond this, but he's part of this community that hangs out at the occult bookstore. And in 1977, Martin Mensch is very excited because he has gotten his hands on a pre-publication manuscript of a new book, because he had some sort of personal relationship with one of the people doing the translation of this book. It was a new occult book, a new translation of a very old book, supposedly.
Okay.
It was a new grimoire, a book of magic. This was a new translation into English of a book that was supposedly, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 years old. And it was a book that was supposed to contain incantations that would allow one to commune with the dead, as well as other supernatural entities. And it would give the practitioner all sorts of insight and mastery over their lives. And he was very excited about this.
Was this book called The Secret?
No. No, it was not. We'll get into that shortly.
All right.
This book did come with a warning. You had to follow these incantations, these instructions, to the letter. Do not mess with them. You are messing with very, very powerful forces that are not to be messed with lightly. Follow these instructions to the letter, or bad things might come into your life.
Right.
You're inviting disaster by messing.
Please tell me you didn't do anything with this.
No demons were summoned.
Okay, good.
In my research for this episode, do not worry.
Nice caveat on there. In your research for this episode, no demons were raised.
Anyway, Martin Mensch, he's very excited about this. So this book contains a series of initiations that you have to go through to work through the incantations in these books. We'll get into that later. But Martin Mensch, he rushes through them. The book is very specific. You're supposed to go through these initiation rites over the course of a year. Martin Mensch, he rushes through them in 2 weeks.
So, pardon me. I just want to make sure I'm following. So you have to, before you can do anything else that's in this book, you have to do the initiation rites?
Yeah.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah. It's a series of rituals and incantations you have to do over the course of a year.
Okay.
Martin Mensch.
Impatient.
Rushes through them in 2 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
And he.
Already a smart guy.
And he feels like he's, you know, he's hearing voices. He's having strange prophetic dreams. And he just feels so much more aware and in tune with the universe. He's very excited that he's getting something out of this book. And he's on his way to the Magical Child bookstore to tell all his friends about this. He gets in a cab to go to the bookstore. He gets out of the cab. Someone approaches him, puts a gun to his head, fires, point blank range, kills him instantly.
What? So, story over?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, that's...
Well, Martin...
Martin Mensch's story is over. There's no clear motive for this crime. It's never solved. The shooter flees, is never caught. And Martin Mensch had no enemies. He was from all accounts, a very well-liked guy who mostly kept to himself.
Right.
The attack appeared to be completely random, unsolved, kind of disappeared into the noise of New York City gun violence.
Okay, well, I mean, New York, 1970s, I mean, random violence, maybe not totally unusual, but kind of weird to just randomly kill someone.
Martin Mensch's friends, they think this was no coincidence. This was because he rushed through the book. He invoked some very powerful forces, but did it improperly and invited disaster into his life.
Right.
So this book, which was just about to be published, it already has this reputation of something that's not to be trifled with lightly.
Okay, so far you haven't named this book. I'm guessing that's on purpose.
It's coming up.
Okay, all right, sorry.
So the interesting thing about this book is not supposed to actually exist, and it's called the Necronomicon.
The Necronomicon is a real book?
Yeah, I got a copy of it here.
From Army of Darkness?
Yeah, I got a copy of it right here.
What?
So.
Let me see this.
You've probably heard of this book. I'm guessing you've heard of it from the Evil Dead movies.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I assumed it was a fictional, it wasn't a real tome. You know what I mean? It was a...
Yeah.
But so, obviously, it was... Okay, you tell the story. You tell the story.
Okay. You know this book from the Evil Dead movies.
Yeah.
That's honestly where I first heard the name too. Actually, when I bought this book, got this at like Chapters, by the way. This was like many, many years ago I bought this book. I remember I just see like the one copy of it in the corner of the shelf in the New Age section.
It was calling out your name.
And I just looked at it, I'm like, Necronomicon, like Ash, Evil Dead, Groovy. Yeah, all that stuff. And I was just kind of looking through it. And this other guy who's like browsing the New Age section at Chapters, this older, kind of creepy looking guy with this long black hair and like eyeliner and very goth looking guy.
Yeah.
He kind of sees me looking at it and he says, "Oh, are you a fan of H.P. Lovecraft?" I'm like, "H.P. Lovecraft. I've heard that name. I haven't read, and I know he's an author. I haven't read any of his work at that point in my life. Like these days, I'm a huge H.P. Lovecraft fan.
Yeah.
But he asked me, I said, "Oh, no, I haven't read any H.P. Lovecraft." And he kind of hums and haws. He says, "You should be careful with that book. I'm going to go over to the cash register."
You're making me nervous now. Yeah.
I'm going to go over to the cash register with my book and get away from this odd guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, the book just kind of sat on my shelf for a very long time. I only bought it as just kind of a curiosity.
Right.
You know, and I briefly read through like the preface, the introduction, the prologue, and I found it really interesting. Then it gets into the real meat of the book, and it's just a bunch of weird incantations and diagrams and rituals. And I'm like, well, this is boring, but it's still like an interesting looking thing to have on my bookshelf. So I'll keep it. So this book, this specific book, we'll get into the backstory in a bit, but what this book is supposed to do.
Wait, pardon me. What's the connection between H.P. Lovecraft?
H.P. Lovecraft, I mean, Necronomicon, it's very popular in pop culture.
Yeah.
Its origin, it was created by H.P. Lovecraft. It was kind of a literary device in H.P. Lovecraft's stories. It was a fictional book within a book.
Okay, so H.P. Lovecraft did not write the Necronomicon.
No.
But he created the Necronomicon as a fictional tome.
Yes.
Within his works.
Yeah.
Okay. So who wrote this book then?
Well, we're gonna get into this
All right. In
a bit.
Okay.
But what this book, what the supposed effects of this book are, and it's very similar as it's told in the writings of H.P. Lovecraft or even Evil Dead to a degree. Completing the rituals in this book will let people gain intuition into the minds of others, commune with the dead and other supernatural entities, invoke or summon elder gods, and be able to borrow some of their power, and through doing that, gain mastery over reality itself. The book comes with a warning. There is no known way to banish the entities you can summon with this book. That's why it's not meant to be messed with.
Right. Am I going to have to do an intervention at some point to get you to, like, stop, like, raising demons. And
I didn't mean to raise any demons.
Forces.
I didn't raise any demons.
You better not have.
I swear I didn't. There's strange effects been reported from even reading the incantations in the book aloud. The incantations, I didn't read them aloud. Barely even touched that part of the book. It's really boring.
Okay.
Anyway, this book, it involves the initiation rites in this book. They involve passing through 9 gates. There's that number 9 again.
Yeah.
9 gates. It's these 9 initiation rituals you have to go through. And at each level, you're supposed to basically be gaining more power and gaining more abilities.
Right. Yeah.
And again, Martin Mensch, unfortunately, rushed through it and clearly angered some ancient elder god. Clearly, that's what happened. But yeah, this book, even after it was published, it gained a lot of notoriety. And it became tied up with all sorts of other stories. Like Marilyn Manson, like the rock star, he even tells a story about this book. About how when he was a teenager, a goth kid, and what do goth kids do? They like to hang out in abandoned buildings and read ancient books of black magic.
Yeah, of course.
Like, what did you do when you were a teenager? Come on.
Yeah, and not that.
Anyway, he tells a story. Like him and his buddies, they were hanging out, you know, in this abandoned building, and one of his friends dares him to read a passage from the Necronomicon aloud. And Marilyn Manson says, "Yeah, I ain't afraid of no book." And he starts reading, you know, these incantations aloud. And he says, as he started reading them, he started hearing like these weird whispers that were coming from inside his own mind, telling him to open the gate, let them in. And he got freaked out. And him and his buddies, they left.
Right.
They left the book there in the building.
Yeah.
The next day, him and his buddies come back because his buddy was like, "Hey, I want my book back."
Yeah.
So they go back to this abandoned building. The book is gone. The entire building is gone. Like it was never there to begin with. It's just an empty lot now.
Ooh.
Now, take that story with a grain of salt because it's coming from Marilyn Manson.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
And, you know, I don't want to throw any shade at Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
A lot of people like Marilyn Manson. I like a few of his songs. I haven't listened to him that extensively. But, I mean, he's definitely a guy who has a very well-manicured persona.
Exactly.
And he would totally tell a story like that to just enhance his own mystique.
Yeah, that's kind of where my mind went as well.
But
hold on, before you continue, so just because I'm not totally clear on who the actual author of this book is, it's named after a fictional tome. Could this just be some highly detailed fanfic?
So the authorship of this book, we'll get into it because it's a bit complicated.
Okay.
We will get into it. But the book itself, you know, there's lots of stories surrounding this book. There's the case of Rod Farrell, the fellow who formed a little cult with his friends and went on a bit of a murder spree in 1996. A copy of the Necronomicon was found in his car.
A bit of a cult.
A little bit of a cult.
And a little murder spree.
Yeah. I'm not going to get too much detail into that story.
I just feel like you're minimizing those plot points a little bit.
You can go on a... I'm not going to say he was like the Manson family. I think he killed like 2 people. Him and his little cult of like 3 or 4 people. You can find that on like a true crime on YouTube. You can watch all about Rod Farrell. I'm not going to get too into him. In the 1985s, there was a rumored Necronomicon cult that was murdering women in the woods in Central Park.
Right.
There's several murders that have actually been tied to this cult, including a woman named Kim Simon. Murder was never solved, but multiple perpetrators were involved. You know, they can tell that much. Never found who they were. And just lots of stories are told about. There's an occult author, John Gaunce. He writes that he worked through the rituals in this book. And he describes being haunted by frightening vibrations. These are his words, not mine.
Okay.
He describes feeling like parts of him were dead and having this intense fear that some evil part of him was going to take over his mind.
That sounds a lot like The Evil Dead.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. But again, this book, it's not supposed to exist. It was invented by H.P. Lovecraft. I just want to talk about H.P. Lovecraft very briefly.
Sure.
Very briefly. Howard Philip Lovecraft, born in 1890 in Providence, Rhode Island. He is kind of the founder of this genre of fiction known as cosmic horror. Basically a blend of science fiction, horror, fantasy, detective stories, all kind of taking place against this very colorful backdrop of late 19th century, early 20th century New England. I absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't read H.P. Lovecraft, you should. It's amazing work. You know, and there's so many like references to H.P. Lovecraft in just all over pop culture. The Necronomicon, you know, Batman has Arkham Asylum. Arkham is the name of a fictitious town where a lot of H.P. Lovecraft stories take place. Basically, H.P. Lovecraft's work, it's kind of an interconnected universe. Like all his stories, they take place in this shared universe.
Right.
And they all involve these ancient elder gods
mm-hmm.
that are very indifferent to humanity.
Cthulhu.
Yes, Cthulhu. Actually, Cthulhu isn't one of the elder gods. He's one of the old ones. There's a difference.
Oh, sorry. Pardon my ignorance.
But, you know, you've got this whole cast of, like, these evil deities in H.P. Lovecraft's fiction. You have what are called the outer gods. You have Azathoth, or the blind idiot god that exists in the bubbling chaos at the center of the universe. You've got Yog-Sothoth, who exists outside of time and perceives all of space and time simultaneously. You've got Shub-Niggurath, the black goat of the woods with 1,000 young. You've got Nyleth-Nyleth-Otep, who's basically like a messenger of the gods in these books.
Yep.
And then you've got Cthulhu, you've got Dagon, they're basically lesser deities, they're called the old ones. Now what's interesting about this whole mythology that H.P. Lovecraft creates is it very much mirrors Sumerian mythology.
Okay.
Sumer, if you're not familiar with it, it's basically the oldest recorded civilization on Earth.
Yeah.
And basically, like, if you look at it, all these deities that Lovecraft is describing coming from outer space, they're all kind of like inverted versions of actually Sumerian deities.
Right. So that's, he's obviously directly drawn inspiration.
Yeah. So basically, and you know, like Cthulhu is obviously a parallel for Tiamat, the primordial chaos dragon of Sumerian mythology that okay. would occasionally rise from the sea and threaten humanity. And while you could temporarily defeat Tiamat, you couldn't actually kill Tiamat, which is kind of like Cthulhu.
So if I'm following correctly, it sounds like H.P. Lovecraft basically brought Sumerian superstition and religion and into the modern context.
Yeah, but it's like an inverted, it's like an inversion of Sumerian mythology. The Sumerians have Enlil, which is supposedly like the high god. It's their god of gods, who's described as being like a kindly lawgiver. And then in
like Odin.
Yeah, yeah, but in H.P. Lovecraft's mythology that he created, occupying kind of the same position, you have Azathoth, who H.P. Lovecraft describes, I'm going to read a quote here, as a mindless chaos that gnaws hungrily in inconceivable, unlighted chambers beyond time and space.
Ooh, okay.
So kind of an inversion.
Right.
Now, if you look at this book, the Necronomicon, the yeah. one I'm holding in my hands and waving around,
yeah,
all these rituals described in this book, they're calling on ancient Sumerian deities.
Right.
So you've already got a connection there between H.P. Lovecraft and Sumeria. And now you have this.
Okay. But someone, just for argument's sake, someone who is invested in authoring a detailed piece of fan fiction based on H.P. Lovecraft's Necronomicon would
yeah.
surely know that connection.
Oh, absolutely.
Incorporated yeah. into this volume. So is there anything to this?
Well, that's the question. This is why this book is so controversial, because people say this book actually works. This book actually does something, good or bad. It's become very controversial in like the occult community, because people say, yeah, I definitely, weird things happened when I started using this book. This is what people say. So how is it this work of fan fiction seems to have this actual power? Well, what's it tapping into?
We've talked about how once it's here we go again, Loeb.
you don't want to hear what Loeb had to say about this.
Oh God! But it doesn't matter maybe so much what where it came from, but the mm-hmm. fact that it exists now, people can now imbue it with energy, and that gives it power. Maybe someone's written this purely for their own entertainment or for other people's entertainment, but now that it exists, it's been brought into the world and can be imbued with that power. That's where my mind goes.
Yeah, that's where my mind immediately went too. But there's even more to it than that, because when you actually look at the kind of the ritual and the magic system described within this book,
yeah,
it's basically borrows a lot from Aleister Crowley.
Right, of course it would.
Yeah. Aleister Crowley had his own magic system that also involved going through these 9 initiations. And through each initiation, you were kind of being imbued with this another layer of godlike power from these different deities. And it was like Aleister Crowley's whole magic system was about confronting these chaotic entities that, while chaotic and somewhat malevolent, could also be very enlightening. I mean, we can get more into Aleister Crowley in a different episode. Like, it's definitely worth an episode.
Yeah.
So I don't want to, like, there's delve a lot too deeply into Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah.
Aleister Crowley, also a contemporary of H.P. Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft mm-hmm. was certainly aware of Aleister Crowley's existence. You know, one of the theories behind, like, this book is it is actually a translation of a much more ancient text. And H.P. Lovecraft was somehow aware of this ancient text and kind of based the Necronomicon in his books off of it.
Right. Okay.
You know, in H.P. Lovecraft's universe, the Necronomicon was written by a man named Abdul Alhazred in 700 BC. And the guy was he was born in Yemen. He became obsessed with the occult and discovering, you know, the hidden secrets of the universe. He traveled extensively, and through his travels, he discovered these horrible secrets about the nature of reality. And he wrote this book. These secrets drove him mad, but he wrote them down in this book. And shortly after writing this book, he was in Damascus, and he was attacked in broad daylight and devoured by invisible beasts. This is the history of the Necronomicon as described by H.P. Lovecraft.
Okay.
This is his version of the Necronomicon.
Yeah. So, but that was an actual grimoire that existed.
No, this is the H.P. Lovecraft version. This is the fictitious version I'm talking about.
Yeah, but you said it was based on a real book.
In theory. That's one of the theories. That's one of the theories. So this book I'm holding.
Is this like the King James Bible? You know, where it's not a direct translation and stuff has been cut out, but it's a distillation of the actual Bible, you know? Is that what I'm getting?
No one really knows what exactly the source material of this book is, but it was published. It was supposedly translated by a man who goes only by Simon. It's a pseudonym.
Like, okay.
Simon prefers to remain anonymous. This book is actually frequently referred to as the Simon Necronomicon, just to differentiate it from the, you know, fictitious H.P. Lovecraft Necronomicon.
Okay.
They'll make that differentiation, and they'll call it the Simon Necronomicon. Published in 1977, Simon claims it was translated from a Greek manuscript that was loaned to him from a monk. I don't know all the details of that, but this is his story. And yeah, when you read it, it seems to be like basically a fusion of Aleister Crowley, Sumerian belief systems, with a little bit of H.P. Lovecraft's fictional universe thrown in there.
Right.
For flavor.
Yeah.
But people say it
It works.
It works. You know, and you know what was going on at the same time? Just a little side note, because I have like a big star next to it in my notes. What was going on at the same time this was published? A man named Philip K. Dick was giving interviews and giving lectures about how he had this encounter with an entity named Valis. That had
right.
Basically...
Oh, yes, I know this story.
Yeah. Because we talked about it on the show.
Oh, we did? Did we cover Valis?
Yes, we did.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I did a whole segment on Philip K. Dick and Valis.
Oh, okay.
I remember it that way anyway. Maybe you're from a different universe.
No, you're right. You're probably right. Again, a display of how faulty the human memory can be.
You know, one of the things that happened that Philip K. Dick talks about so much is... And you had actually mentioned it in the show, is sometimes what happens with fiction, it's like the author is channeling something.
Yes.
You know, Paul McCartney, the lyrics for Yesterday came to him in a dream. Philip K. Dick started living scenes that he had written in his past novels, you know, later in life. So this theory starts circulating that H.P. Lovecraft, he was channeling something from across space and time and incorporating this real book into his fiction.
Right, right.
But anyway, he...
So kind of the threads of power are all there to connect. And, you know, it's funny, as you've been talking about this, it reminds me, it feels like a theme that comes up over and over again, just the creative power of writing and how it sometimes it feels like... I was doing research for hopefully a future episode, and I was reading a whole article by Nick Redfern about an author who wrote about, he was writing crime novels, and he wrote the details of his own death, right?
Oh, wow.
In his novel that was written in advance, and then it all unfolded in real life. Right. So you see this pattern happening over and over again. And like you said, we've mentioned on previous episodes. So maybe when people are doing something, even if they're doing it purely for entertainment purposes, purely just as a creative act, there's something else going on there, you know, that can bring things into reality.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, it kind of there are times where you kind of wonder whether something was created. Or discovered, you know, the creative act. Are you making something wholesale, or was it always there and you're just discovering it?
Yeah.
You know, what was it like? Michelangelo, I think, would always say that when he was carving a statue.
Yeah, the statue was already there in the rock or in the marble. He just took away the extra bits.
Yeah,
that's right.
So anyway, where was I? I was talking about.
Yeah, I'm really hanging on the edge of my seat to figure out where you're going with all this.
this book, Fusion, H.P. Lovecraft, Sumerian Beliefs, and Aleister Crowley. People say it actually works. They experience actual effects from using this book. And what people say is that even a made-up magical system, even if this was invented... by this character Simon as just fan fiction, basically. And he wanted to publish a book and he threw some H.P. Lovecraft references in there to, you know, increase its appeal. People say it actually works, but people say, you know, even an invented magical system can still hold power as long as internally its rules are consistent.
Hmm.
That's something Aleister Crowley brings up a lot too. You know, you keep the internal rules because it's all about intent.
Yeah.
It's all about intent. You know, magic is...
Manifestation?
Yeah. Magic is not as it's practiced. You know, magic as it's practiced.
The law of attraction?
Yeah. It's not so different from like psi phenomenon, as you call it.
Yeah.
It's just a different system for getting to that same place.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this book takes kind of a dark path in getting there.
Right.
And that's why... so many horrible events seem to be associated with it. I'm not a huge believer in the occult. I'm not. Yeah. Neither was H.P. Lovecraft, actually. H.P. Lovecraft was an atheist, but he was very fascinated by the occult.
Yeah.
I kind of fall into the same boat.
Agreed, yeah. It's It's fun stuff. It's interesting. Yeah.
But at the same time, I did not ever read aloud from any of the passages in this book.
I'm glad.
Because why? You know what?
Stop hitting it, though.
You know,
it's coming through on the mic.
I try not to tempt fate these days.
Yeah, are you sure? Because I feel like the whole Loeb thing. What was it? Loeb? I always get the name wrong.
Loeb. That being said, I will now favor you with a passage from the Necronomicon.
Don't. Put it
I'm
down.
I'm just kidding. I wouldn't read aloud. I would not risk cursing our whole audience.
I feel like I got to go to your apartment. We got to find all of your books and all your computers that you've been talking to demons on. And we got to have a bonfire and burn some sage and cleanse whatever's going on with you here.
You don't want to hear what Loeb had to say about this book. You really don't.
All right. So do you have a conclusion? I feel like we're driving right towards something here.
Not really.
No, just the end.
That's the Necronomicon. Interesting stuff, but,
be careful.
I mean, be cautious. You know, it's funny. Like, I picked up this book in chapters.
Yep.
And, you know, every time I'm in a bookstore and I see this book, there's always one copy of it. And it's just kind of tucked away, like, in the corner.
Right.
And it's like, this isn't something we're going to order. We're only ever going to order one copy of this because, there's not a huge demand for it, but there's always, like, some weirdo that's going to come along and buy it. That's me. I'm that weirdo.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I feel like that's probably just good merchandising.
Yeah.
You know? Like, they know, we only ever put one of these on the shelf because it takes away from the mystique if there's 15 in a row.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's probably what it is good merchandising.
Yeah, what do you think? What do you think about this?
Well, I think we basically covered it already. I feel like this book and probably all that lies within it was probably written innocently enough as entertainment by someone very enthusiastic about, you know, Sumerian culture and H.P. Lovecraft and wanted to create something, you know, interesting for fans of that material and fans of H.P. Lovecraft. That doesn't mean it doesn't carry some power with it, because now it exists, now it's in the world, now people are reading it and reading from it. And that intention and that energy, even just the creative energy that went into creating it and bringing it into existence in the first place, can have some power.
Yeah.
That's where I land with it.
And I will tell you, even just doing the research for this episode and reading into this book and its history, I started having some strange dreams myself, some scary dreams.
Oh yeah.
I was, I remember I texted you earlier this week because I was playing around with my image generating AI.
Yes.
And I got all freaked out because I'm like, I managed to get Midjourney to accept one of those negative prompts. I like typed this really weird lengthy set of commands into Midjourney and got it to accept one of those. And this weird, spooky, creepy image appeared.
Oh yeah, just, you sent it to me. Like it looked like just like a blood-stained bandage or something.
Yeah,
weird.
But just with like the hint of like the ghost of a face emerging from it, and it was just this really creepy. And like that's just how Loeb was made. But I was all freaked out because we're not going to use that for the show.
I was pissed at you. I was like, why do you keep doing this? Like, cut it out.
You were like, stop summoning demons. But I was freaked out because like, this image kept regenerating itself over and over and over again on my feed. When I was trying to work on other stuff, this image kept popping back up like it was haunting me or something.
Yeah.
And even as we were starting to record the show, this really freaked me out. I know it was just an audio setting we flubbed, but it was like we recorded the first 20 minutes of the show and you were talking and the mic was picking, we were using the same mic.
Yeah.
The mic was picking up your voice and I was sitting right next to the mic. It was like I was completely silent. You couldn't hear anything I was saying, even though I'm sitting right next to the mic. But it was recording you.
Yeah, that was really strange. Yeah, because we're using the same microphone. We tried the first time. We got a second mic doing a two mic setup and something wasn't working. And yeah, so we switched back to our default single microphone. We're both sitting the exact same distance from it. It's recording my voice, but it wasn't recording yours.
Yeah.
What Weird. Have you done? We need to smudge you, brother.
I'm fine.
I've got some sage. We'll take care of that before you go.
This ordeal is concluded. And, I
think you got to burn this book, too.
That's like the worst thing to do to like a cursed object is to burn it.
You release its energy, right?
Yeah.
So you need to lock it in like a lead box and bury it in the woods or something.
No, I need to.
So someone can stumble upon it. And
I need to.
The curse can land on them.
I need to throw it in the ocean. It can, sit down there with Cthulhu.
Yeah, there you go. It'd probably be the thing that raises him. Anyway, okay. Sufficiently freaked out all over again. Thanks for keeping it light this episode.
You're most welcome.
Appreciate it. Okay, well, I don't know about you, but I'm ready for a break. I'm looking forward to this. You know, I really went back and forth. There was part of me going, no, don't, the show's doing great. Don't lose momentum. I don't want people to lose us. But we're human beings. We got to take a break. I need it. I know you need it. I know you're going to have a lot of fun on your vacation. So, appreciate everyone hanging on for a couple weeks, and we'll be back for season 2. So, yeah. Good night, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.